Chapter 2. What gets into our minds? Perception. Look steadily at the drawing in Figure 2. This picture of a Necker cube is made up entirely of black lines in two-dimensional space, but what you perceive is a three-dimensional cube. Looking for some time at this cube produces an apparent reversal, so that the face that was in front becomes the back face of a cube facing the other way. These representations alternate even if you try not to let them do so, as the brain attempts to make sense of an ambiguous drawing with insufficient information to settle for one interpretation or the other. It seems that perception is not just a matter of passively picking up information from the senses, but the product of an active construction process. Even more confusing is the drawing of the devil's tuning fork in Figure 3, which misleads us by using standard cues for depth perception. Alternately, we can see, or cannot see, a three-dimensional representation of a three-pronged fork. Similar phenomena can be demonstrated using other senses. If you repeat the word "say" to yourself quickly and steadily, you will alternately hear "say, say, say" and "ace, ace, ace." The point is the same. The brain works on the information received and makes hypotheses about reality without our conscious direction, so that what we are ultimately aware of is a combination of sensory stimulation and interpretation. If we are driving in thick fog or trying to read in the dark, then the guesswork becomes obvious. Is this our turning or a driveway? Does it say head or dead? Sensory processes partly determine what gets into our minds, but we can already see that other, more hidden and complex processes also contribute to what we perceive. We generally assume that the world is as we see it and that others see it the same way, that our senses reflect an objective and shared reality. We assume that our senses represent the world in which we live as accurately as a mirror reflects the face that peers into it, or as a camera creates a snapshot of a particular instant, frozen in time. Of course, if our senses did not provide us with somewhat accurate information, we could not rely on them as we do. But nevertheless, psychologists have found that these assumptions about perception are misleading. Picking up information about our worlds is not a passive, reflective process, but a complex, active one in which the mind and the senses work together, helping us to construct a perception of reality. We do not just see patterns of light, dark, and color. We organize these patterns of stimulation so that we see objects that have meaning for us. We can name or recognize them and identify them as entirely new or similar to other objects. As we shall hear throughout this book, the subject matter of psychology is never simple, and some of its commonest problems are illustrated by the work on perception. First, we have to determine which are the relevant factors. Sensation, interpretation, and attention are three in this case. Then attempt to understand and construct theories to explain the ways in which they interact. Most psychological research into perception has concentrated on visual perception, because vision is our best developed sense. About half the cortex, or the convoluted gray matter in the brain, is related to vision. Visual examples can also be illustrated, so they will predominate in this chapter. Perceiving the real world. The first stage of perception involves detecting the signal that something is out there. The human eye can detect only a minute fraction of 1% of all electromagnetic energy, the visible spectrum. Bees and butterflies can see ultraviolet rays, and bats and porpoises can hear sounds 2 octaves beyond our range. So what we know about reality is limited by the capabilities of our sense organs. Within those limitations, Our sensitivity is remarkable. On a clear, dark night, we could theoretically see a single candle flame 30 miles away. When we detect a signal, such as a light, our sensory receptors convert one form of energy into another. So information about the light is transmitted as a pattern of neural impulses. The raw material of perception for all the senses consists of neural impulses, which are channeled to differently specialized parts of the brain. For the impulses to be interpreted as seeing a candle flame, they have to reach the visual cortex, and the pattern and rate of firing in activated cells and lack of firing in inhibited cells has both to be distinguished from the background level of cellular activity or neural noise and decoded. Interestingly, the ability to detect a signal accurately is far more variable than would be expected from knowledge about sensory systems alone, and is influenced by many other factors. Some are obvious, like attention, others less obvious, involving our expectations, motivations, or inclinations, such as a tendency to say yes or no when uncertain. If you are listening to the radio while waiting for an important telephone call, you may think you heard it ring when it did not. Whereas if you are engrossed in the radio program and not expecting a phone call, you may completely fail to hear it ring. Such differences in detecting signals have important practical implications. For example, in designing effective warning systems in intensive care units, or control panels for complex machines. Theories constructed to explain these findings enable psychologists to make and to test predictions. Signal detection theory suggests that accurate perception is determined not just by sensory capacity, but by a combination of sensory processes and decision processes. Decisions vary according to the degree of cautiousness required or response bias in use at the time. A laboratory technician scanning slides for cancerous cells responds to every anomaly and sorts out the false alarms later, but a driver deciding when to overtake the car in front must get it right each time or risk a collision. Measures of sensitivity and of cautiousness can be calculated by counting hit rates and false alarms, and applying relatively simple statistical procedures to predict when a signal, a cancerous cell, or an oncoming car will be accurately detected. These measures are demonstrably reliable and have many practical uses, for example, in training air traffic controllers, whose decisions about the presence or absence of a radar signal may make the difference between a safe landing and a disaster. All senses respond better to changes in the environment than to a steady state, and receptors stop responding altogether or habituate when nothing changes. So you notice the noise of the fridge when it switches on, but not later. In our busy lives, one might suppose that rest from sensory stimulation would be a boon. But sensory deprivation, or the absence of all sensory stimulation, can induce frightening and bizarre experiences, including hallucinations in some people. The degree of distress experienced varies according to what people expect. The same applies if the senses are overloaded for a significant length of time. As people who have recently been to pop concerts, football matches, or especially busy supermarkets will testify, these can be stimulating, exhausting, or confusing experiences. Perceptual organization. Organized perception, which enables us to discern patterns in what we perceive so as to make sense of it, happens so naturally and effortlessly that it is hard to believe it is a substantial achievement. Computers can be programmed to play chess, but they cannot yet be programmed to match even relatively rudimentary visual skills. The main principles of perceptual organization were discovered by the Gestalt psychologists in the 1930s. Look at the Rubens vase in Figure 4. You will see either a vase or two silhouettes, but not both at once. If you look at the vase, the silhouettes disappear, becoming the ground against which the figure stands out. But seeing the silhouettes as figures turns the vase into background. Figure ground perception is important because it forms the basis for much of the rest of the way that we see things. Three of the other Gestalt principles of organization, those of similarity, proximity, and closure, are illustrated in Figure 5. Perceptually, we group together things that are similar or close to each other, as in A and B, and fill in the gaps if shown an incomplete figure, as in C. These organizing principles help us to identify objects and to separate them from their surroundings. We usually identify the most important figures first and explore details later. So in Figure 6, we see H before S. Whether or not perceptual processing always proceeds in this order is still uncertain. The point is that one of the things we contribute to the construction of our own reality is a systematic way of organizing the information received. Gestalt psychologists believed that our ability to identify objects visually and to distinguish them from the background is innate rather than learned. From recordings of single cells in the brain, it appears that some cells respond most to lines having a specific orientation or length, and others may detect simple shapes or surfaces. Are we born with such specialized detectors, or do they develop later? Adults who were blind at birth but subsequently gained their sight, for example, following the surgical removal of cataracts, have all found visual perception extremely difficult and continue to make visual errors. Although there could be many reasons for this, it seems that visual skills have to be learned. For example, animals reared in diffuse light, which preserves the optic nerve but prevents pattern discrimination, tend subsequently to bump into things. The extent to which perception is influenced by stored knowledge and the expectations created by this knowledge is remarkable. Creating a perceptual set, or an expectation that guides perception, makes it easier to perceive something belonging to that set, which is why the own brand items in a supermarket will be easier to find if they look similar to each other and different from rival brands. Perceptual set. What you know influences what you see. Subjects were shown sets of letters or numbers which they had to name out loud as they appeared. Then they were shown the following ambiguous figure, the number 13. This could be read as a B or a 13. If it followed a series of letters, it was named as B, but if it followed a series of numbers, it was named as a 13. Paying attention, making use of a limited capacity system. Perception involves more than the acquisition of discriminatory skills. It also involves forming hypotheses, making decisions, and applying organizing principles. Most of the time, these things go on outside awareness, and sometimes we can even be unaware that we have perceived, or chosen to perceive, anything at all. This is because what gets into our mind is determined by the way our perceptual system works, and also by the way in which we select from amongst the many things that demand our attention. Our brains are limited capacity systems, and to make the best use of them, it helps to direct our attention appropriately. If you set a tape recorder running at a noisy party, you would most likely hear something resembling a confused babble. But if you start talking, or paying attention, to someone at the party, your conversation will stand out against the background noise, and you may not even know whether the person behind you was talking in French or English. Yet, if someone mentions your name, without even raising their voice, you will be highly likely to notice it. Normally, we focus as we wish by filtering out what does not matter to us at the time, on the basis of low-level information, such as the voice of the speaker or direction from which the voice comes. Noticing our own name is a puzzling exception to this rule, and several explanations have been suggested for how the filter system works. We must know something about those things we ignore, or we would not know that we wanted to ignore them. Perceiving something without realizing that we have done so has been called subliminal perception. Laboratory studies have shown that our attentional processes can work so fast and efficiently that they can protect us from consciously noticing things that might upset us, such as obscene or disturbing words. Subliminal perception, a means of self-protection? Two spots of light are shown on a screen, and in one of them a word is written so faintly that it cannot be consciously perceived. Subjects judge the brightness of the spots as dimmer when there is an emotional word hidden in the light than when the word is pleasant or neutral. This has been called perceptual defense because it potentially can protect us from unpleasant stimuli. Paying attention is one way in which we select what gets into our minds, but we do not have to pay attention to only one thing at a time. In fact, divided attention is the norm. We can divide our attention most easily between information coming to us through different channels, which is why I can keep an eye on the stew while peeling the potatoes and listening to the children. I can even worry about the letter from the bank manager at the same time, but there are limits to my versatility. Air traffic controllers were once trained to do many things simultaneously. Watch a radar screen, talk to pilots, track different flight paths, and read messages handed to them on paper. Provided the flow of traffic was manageable, they could divide their attention in all these ways at once. However, during the development of safety systems, simulated tests of their capacity showed that if the flow of information was too great, or if they were tired, their responses became disorganized and even quite bizarre, standing up and pointing out directions to pilots thousands of feet up in the air and many miles away, or shouting loudly to get the information across. It will be no surprise to learn that attention is a sensitive process. Many factors have been found to interfere with it, such as similarity between stimuli, difficulty of the task, lack of skill or practice, distress or worry, preoccupation or absent-mindedness, drugs, boredom, and sensory habituation. One reason why it is safer to use railways to transport people through a long underground tunnel, such as the one under the channel between France and England, is that driving would be too risky. Without sufficient sensory variety, perceptual systems habituate and attention wanders. We adapt or habituate to stimuli that do not change and orient towards something new. So, lying quite still in the bath, I will not notice the gradual temperature change until I suddenly move about. What we actually perceive in combining perception and attention is thus influenced by internal factors such as emotions and bodily states, as well as by external factors. People who fear social rejection more readily notice signs of unfriendliness than of friendliness, such as negative facial expressions, and hungry people judge pictures of food as more brightly colored than pictures of other things. These findings confirm that so much of perception goes on outside awareness that we cannot be sure that there is a good match between what we perceive and reality, or between what we perceive and what others perceive. Psychologists have suggested that two kinds of processing are involved. Bottom-up processing starts when we see something out in the real world which triggers a set of internal cognitive processes. This stimulus-driven processing reflects our responsiveness to the outside world and tends to prevail when viewing conditions are good. top-down processing reflects the contribution of conceptually driven central processes. Even when reacting to light or sound waves, each of us brings past experience and attention to the task. And if the viewing conditions are poor or our expectations are strong, we will rely more on internal and less on external information. Glance at the triangle in Figure 7 to see what it says. Did you notice the error? Most people do not do so at first, as their expectations about the well-known phrase or top-down processing interfere with accurate perception or bottom-up processing. Contemporary theories of perception have changed to take such observations into account. For example, Ulrich Neisser suggested that we use schemas built up from past experience to make sense of the world. Our past experience leads us to form expectations about objects or events, schemas, and we use these schemas to anticipate what we are likely to encounter. Our schemas, which have been developing since infancy, direct our exploration of the perceptual world. So we sample incoming information and modify schemas according to what we find. According to this view, perception is a continuous active cycle, rather than a one-way process or a passive snapshot of what is there. What we anticipate or expect affects what we perceive, but what is actually there affects what we anticipate. Imagine you are meeting a friend in a crowd. You expect he will look much the same as usual, so you look out for a tall man with a beard and ignore short, clean-shaven ones. Suddenly, your friend taps you on the shoulder. You have missed him because he shaved off his beard. If you modify your schema accordingly, you may not miss him next time. So our expectations are continually changing and adjusting as we take in new information, and our perceptual system helps us to adapt in ways that some other animals cannot do. A frog catches a fly by perceiving its movement and will die of starvation if surrounded by stationary, but edible, dead flies. Learning from perceptual impairment, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. The complexities of perception mean that it can go wrong in many different ways. In The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Oliver Sacks describes what happens when more complex, interpretive perceptual abilities are seriously impaired. His patient was a talented musician with no deterioration in his musical or other mental abilities. He was aware that he made mistakes, particularly in recognizing people, but not otherwise aware that anything much was wrong. He could converse normally, but no longer recognize his students, and confused inanimate objects, such as his shoe, with animate ones, his foot. At the end of an interview with Dr. Sacks, he looked for his hat, but instead reached for and tried to lift off his wife's head. He could not recognize the emotional expressions or the sex of people seen on TV, and he could not identify members of his family from their photographs, even though he could do so by their voices. Sacks reports that, visually, he was lost in a world of lifeless abstractions, as if he had lost an important organizing principle. He could see the world as a computer construes it, by means of key features and schematic relationships, so that when asked to identify a glove, he described it as a container of some sort, and as a continuous surface infolded on itself, which appears to have five outpouchings. This severe perceptual impairment affected visual recognition more than other things, as if he could see without understanding or interpreting what he saw. Bereft of the interpretive aspect of perception, he came to a complete stop if he had to rely on visual information alone, but was able to keep going by humming to himself, by living in the musical, auditory world for which he was especially skilled. Although he could make hypotheses about his wife's head or the glove, as indeed we do when looking at the Necker cube. He could not make judgments about those things. Studying carefully the selective impairment of high-level perceptual functions provides clues that help us to understand many things, the part that those functions play, not only in perception, but in helping us to live in the real world, which functions are separately coded in the brain, and where the organization of those functions is located. So, perception is the end product of complex processes, many of which take place out of awareness. Psychologists have now learned so much about perception that they can simulate a visual environment sufficiently accurately for trainee surgeons to use virtual reality to practice doing complex operations. Virtual reality creates the illusion of three-dimensional space, so that it becomes possible to reach round something or pass through solid objects at the touch of a button. Perceptual systems are able to learn and adapt so quickly, however, that being able to do this is a mixed blessing. Surgeons who have practiced like this sufficiently long to readjust their use of standard perceptual cues for moving around safely in three-dimensional space are especially prone to car accidents afterwards. This introduction to the field of perception only starts to answer questions about what gets into the mind. The subject covers many more fascinating topics, ranging from ideas about perceptual development to debates about the degree to which the processes involved in perception are automatic or can be intentionally controlled. The aim has been to illustrate the point that reality as we know it is partly an individual human construction. Each of us makes it up as we go along, and psychologists help us to understand many of the conditions which determine how we do this. Knowing something about what gets into the mind, we can go on to ask how much of it stays there to become the basis for what we learn and remember.